720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and happy New Year's Eve to you. I hope you have wonderful, meaningful, cozy, and safe plans tonight. We're watching all the Chi-Town Rising stuff get underway. Lots of people out and lots of people already downtown. So it should be a really interesting evening. Lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch as ever. And we are joined by our friend Mike Lenz. He has been on this show before. Regular listeners will remember him. He is the co-founder of Tip Yourself, which is an app that helps you set a little money aside or a lot of money aside, however much money you want
to
set aside.
It's up to you, I suppose.
And we talked about this when you first launched in February, and you're here to give us a little update. How's everything going with Tip Yourself?
It's been an extraordinary year. So from just launching in February and just putting something out there that we believed in as a team, the members have really rallied behind it. We've grown tremendously, and people have tipped themselves over $500,000 already this year.
Okay, that'll do.
That's extraordinary.
That's a heck of a tip jar right there.
Yeah, it absolutely
is. Well, so for people who maybe missed when you came in before to visit, talk us through how Tip Yourself works a bit.
Yeah, so Tip Yourself's a fun way to kind of shift your mindset of what it means to save money. We like to say you tip everybody else, but why don't you tip yourself? And, you know, think about saving money as that, a reward that you give yourself. And so it's less about how much and more about why. So maybe it's you had a tough day at work. Maybe you're trying to reward yourself for going to the gym, whatever that might be, whatever that little moment of victory is for you. Tip yourself. So just put a couple bucks in your own tip jar and, you know, stash it away for a rainy day.
I've been saying for years we need like adult merit badges.
There
like,
you go.
I changed the air filter. Nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Like you know, you get those tips all the time for those like stubborn to-do list things. You're like, oh, I know I need to do that.
Right.
And you're just holding off. That's definitely worth the tip.
I don't do the gutters, but I did it. And I'm going to tip myself.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
Okay. And so $500,000, that is pretty good that the community has tipped themselves. Mm-hmm. And so as people are tipping themselves for a variety of reasons, I love it, too, that it's very positive.
Yes.
It's not like I know there's a couple of apps that will automatically donate money to a charity if you don't go to the gym or if you don't do the thing you say. But this is positive. I like that it's very, very positive. But it seems like there's a very big New Year's Eve resolution kind of component to this too, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a fun time of year. It's that fresh start. And, you know, fresh starts are always a really great opportunity to truly change a behavior. It's very tough for us to build new habits, any of us. And you want to take advantage of those opportunities. And New Year's is really a big one to say, all right, this is a fresh start, new me, and how I'm going to build this new habit or, achieve this new New Year's resolution. And rewarding yourself for those small steps along the way is a really powerful way to keep yourself motivated along that path.
Certainly. And as you're building, as Tip Yourself is growing and becoming a larger company, you're partnering with other organizations to do some events. Tell us about the one you have coming up later in January.
Yeah, for those here in Chicago, State Farm has a great community space up in Lincoln Park called Next Door. And we are going to be hosting a free habit building workshop with them on January 24th. So come on out. And we're going to be talking all the psychology around habits and how you really kind of build a plan and change your own behavior.
That's really interesting. That's something we've been talking about a lot on this station and this show, trying to, you know, for like entrepreneurs to have very healthy financial habits or get in new habits to try to level things up in the year ahead, things like that.
So absolutely.
And is that geared more towards individuals or entrepreneurs or all the above?
All the above. So it's a really great space. It's focused around finances and bettering your finances, but it's really a lot of things. They have programs around, you know, getting into blogging and managing your WordPress thing. It's just really this great resource for the community. And I reached out to them and said, hey, we'd love to do this workshop on habits. And they rallied right behind it. They love it. So it's going to be something to be fun. So come on out January 24th.
And it's free.
It's free.
Even better. We
Even
love
better.
That price. And do people need to pre-register? Do they need to go to tipyourself.com to do that or
you
just
can.
Show up?
So if you RSVP, you could definitely guarantee you have a spot. So if you go to our Facebook page, just go to Facebook, search for Tip Yourself. All the details are right there in our feed.
Great. So everybody go to that because that sounds really exciting. And we can all, I think anytime there's a workshop, and especially when it's free.
Oh, and habits are important. It's everything. I mean,
yeah.
It's about 40% of the stuff we do is habits.
So what kind of an overview, you know, I know you can't give it all away now, but kind of what kind of things will you be covering in that workshop about habits?
So specific tips and tactics you can do to truly change behaviors. Like we talked about before, I think we all know how hard it is. You know, we can all count those different New Year's resolutions we've had that we just failed to make stick. And that's common. It's very difficult to change behavior. We're creatures of habit. But there are very specific psychology, science behind it that you can deploy to understand like how you could truly change behavior. So we're going to talk about what exactly is a habit, the different parts of it, the habit loop of that kind of experience, and then very specific tactics to put a plan in place to change your behavior.
That's really, really great. And I think I'm going to have to check this, but I just remember that I think it's somewhere around that day is when it's like give up your resolution
day. Oh, my
day.
Goodness, yeah.
So
probably.
It's kind of perfectly timed because I think it's sort of the average of how long people will stick
right
with a resolution.
Right when you're about to fall off. Let's get refocused.
Right
yes.
when you're about to fall off. I love that. And so what are some of the, as this community has grown, what are some of the more creative uses? Because I'm sure you've gotten to know some mm-hmm. people in the community. Creative uses that you've seen of people using Tip Yourself? Because I love the positive message, but have people done it for maybe like a fundraising thing or, mm-hmm. or maybe for a specific goal or something like that?
Yeah. So some of the fun things we've seen is really around positive moments. What was really encouraging is that when we built Tip Yourself, my co-founder Lucas and I, it was about, you know, building habits and accomplishing things and saving money, this very kind of focused task-based approach. But as we've grown, what we found, a lot of people really like it for just the positivity. So the real special moments is when someone comes in and just says, hey, I had a tough day at work and I'm tipping myself just to feel better. And then you see this community rally around them. They're posting comments to their tip and saying, hey, stick in there, you know, hang with it. And so it's been really encouraging to see just that power of the positivity in just general moments. You know, it's not really trying to build anything or work towards a specific goal. It's just, hey, I had a tough day, but I'm going to recognize that, you know, I can turn my mindset around.
Yeah, I think there'll be some good stories in the year ahead. I know
Absolutely.
Someone who several years ago quit smoking, but every time she wanted to have a cigarette and did not, mm-hmm. she would put, I think, $1 or $5 something
that
in a jar.
Up.
And at the end of the year, she realized, oh, I got a lot of cash sitting here.
Nice vacation. Yeah, get yourself out of the Chicago winter for a little bit there
right.
with that money.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. So I predict as Tip Yourself grows, I think you'll start hearing more stories of people that have done cool stuff with their little piles of money.
Absolutely. It's always fun. Like you said, it's your money, though. Like we have a lot of moms and parents that say, listen, all the other money goes to my kids. This tip jar, that's my money.
It's mine.
My money.
That's my piggy bank.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, Mike Lenz, co-founder of Tip Yourself, thanks so much for being with us
Amy,
today.
Amy, thank you so much for having me.
And everybody, head to social media, Facebook, Twitter, all the good stuff, and tipyourself.com, and you can find out how to download this app for
iPhone right now, but it will be for all phones in the new year.
Excellent.
So we're working on it.
Okay, sounds good. All right, thanks for being with us today. We will be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. And 20 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and happy New Year's to you. Still lots to do on the program today. Many, many things to discuss. Just because it's a holiday, the holiday time and a holiday weekend doesn't mean that there is any shortage of business stories to talk about. Joining us now is a regular contributor to this program, Samantha Baumkamp from Chicago Tribune. Hey, Sam, how are you?
Hey, great. Happy New Year, Amy.
Happy New Year to you. So you write about so many things, and we all follow you closely and follow you on social media. And I have really been interested in how much of the recent McDonald's headlines that you have been writing about, particularly this movie. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So it's a really fascinating kind of look at the founder, which comes out January 20th around the Chicago area. And it is about the founding of McDonald's, but a lot of people assume that Ray Kroc, the name we most associate with McDonald's, was the creator. And actually, it was the McDonald's brothers opening a restaurant in California that Ray Kroc saw and felt like he needed to replicate. And the rest is obviously history.
Mm. And so is there anything controversial about this movie? Are people, you know, are people kind of, or I'd say the buzz rather, is it like, you know, because if it's based on a book, people right. are always like, oh, they changed this part. But is there anything that seems to be like a point of contention with either family, the McDonald's or the Crocs?
Yeah, for sure. The really interesting part about the last 60 years, ever since McDonald's has been in existence, is that we've largely got Kroc's side of the story. I mean, he was the creator of the franchise system and responsible for hundreds and hundreds of McDonald's and creating the system that we see today in every restaurant across the country and across the world. But the McDonald's brothers really had a different side of how the whole company got into being. They felt like Kroc was a milkshake machine salesman when they first encountered him, and they thought he swindled them and took advantage of them and eventually essentially tricked them out of their family business to take it for himself. Obviously, we've seen mostly Kroc's side of the story because he is the more prominent name in McDonald's history. But it's really interesting to see this movie for the first time take it kind of from the McDonald's brothers' point of view and see that Ray Kroc was this 52-year-old salesman, and at times he's portrayed as, you know, an unscrupulous guy, a kind of guy that takes advantage of these brothers to get what he wants.
That's really very interesting. And anytime we have a story that's kind of showing how many narratives there are around every single thing, right? There's never just one story. There's always many stories. And those are, I'm so interested in those. And so I'm very, very interested in this film. Is the, it seems like there's been a lot of, I don't want to say activism, but maybe some activism directed towards McDonald's rather, for anything from, you know, low wages to there was agricultural practices that was kind of on the up called to the mat at one point, even unhealthy food. I remember the, you know, the pink slime story a couple of years ago, all of that stuff. Does that show up in this, or is this really just focusing on those early years of McDonald's creation and the McDonald's brothers?
Well, that's a fascinating thing that I got to explore in the story. We got to take a look at, compare it to kind of the impact of Super Size Me, for example, the documentary about 10 years ago where we saw just this enormous and immediate impact on McDonald's Corporation. I mean, the Super Size fries and drinks went away, and a Go Active campaign that encouraged exercise and healthy eating habits was ushered in. And so we really saw like this just unprecedented impact on McDonald's. Now, most people I spoke to this time said the founder, you know, not being a documentary, obviously being a dramatization of what the filmmakers see as both sides, that won't have nearly the impact of a Super Size Me, but still. A marketing professor at Northwestern just gave me a really fascinating view. We're talking about in the age of Trump, we see this wealthy guy coming in and winning the presidency, whereas in the last 8 years we have seen Fight for 15 and the quote little guy rise up and gain some power. So it's really the dichotomy of that in our political climate right now, and then looking at McDonald's and all those things that you mentioned really coming together and seeing that's why we're so just kind of riding on it and so curious about the impact of this movie, because there's just so many things in our culture itself that are bubbling up.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like an interesting time, and I've always been interested in that connection between the movies being made, the movies that are doing well, the ones we're all going to see, and what's kind of up for us politically and socially in that moment, because I think that's always an interesting reflection in literature too, right? There's always that kind of there's always that connection. There's always sort of the filmmakers and artists and writers always responding to what's happening culturally in that moment. So this is a very interesting one, and everybody head to chicagotribune.com and check out this story as well as many, many others. Another one that you've written about also in the McDonald's realm is a little before you wrote about this one, but nonetheless, it might have gotten lost in the Christmas time shuffle, and that is this story about this guy who is being sued over value meal prices, which is so interesting because at the end of the day, you just want to go, this is really just about very simple math, but nonetheless, we are in a litigious moment, and speaking of culture.
Right.
And it's a local man who has filed a lawsuit against a McDonald's franchisee alleging that the restaurant operator has deceived him. Tell us a bit about that. Because it seems like it's, how can that be real? But no, here we are.
Well, that's a fascinating one. It's a franchisee that has correct me if I'm wrong, but about 10 restaurants around the area. And this man that's the plaintiff that's suing says that he's gone consistently to these McDonald's, rotated around these McDonald's as this particular man operates, and that the value meal, the two cheeseburger value meal, has consistently been a little less than 50 cents more than buying those things individually. Now, he obviously thinks that this is counterintuitive to the whole value meal proposition, but surprisingly, the backlash, if any, that I the reader emails that I got in response to that story were not, go guy, fight for the little guy, fight for this this price, but it was people saying, McDonald's can charge whatever the heck it wants. So it brought up this interesting question, what does a value meal really mean? They're not necessarily saying, they never promise that it's less expensive, although that is absolutely the intention of saying value meal. So it brought up this interesting question. And obviously, as you mentioned, people will sue about anything these days.
Sure. Well, I don't know about you, but when I figure out like a way to get a deal on something, or if I get a coupon code for a store that I want to go to, I usually, just keep that to myself and enjoy the deal. I don't necessarily, but it is interesting, right? Because it's really all about semantics. It's all about what we say. We, by calling it a value meal, there's this expectation, but that very well could be one of those things like labeling a product natural or educational. There's really nothing to regulate that or promise the consumer that that's indeed the least expensive, the most natural, the most educational, or, any of those things. So it's to me, it's about being a savvy consumer, but
right,
no one's
right.
Asked me to run the world yet. So, well, thank you so much for being with us today, Samantha Baumkamp from Chicago Tribune. We will keep turning to you at chicagotribune.com for this and many other stories. Thanks very much, and Happy New Year to you.
Thanks, you too.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you up to news, and then we'll be right back in a bit to continue talking all about business stories happening right now. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. We'll keep you updated and keep checking in upstairs with news about street closures and everything going on downtown, and as well as public transportation. But one thing, if you were listening, I hope you took note of, that the CTA is running the free rides tonight. So between that and Uber and Lyft and taxis and all that good stuff, everybody please be safe no matter what you're doing, and plan ahead to have safe travels tonight. That is my one ask of you. I don't ask much from you, but I'm asking you that. All right. Still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're joined now by John Flavin, Associate Vice President of the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. Welcome back to the program, John. How are you? And Happy New Year.
I'm doing well. Happy New Year, Amy.
Thanks for being with us today. So I would love to chat with you about this investment, about $25 million invested in startups, or to be invested in startups, rather, by U of C. Tell us about that a bit.
Yes, well, Amy, we've been spending the last several years, building really an engine to create ventures. The Polsky Center helps innovators across campus, whether it be faculty or students, and even area entrepreneurs, take their idea and try to get it market ready. We do this by providing educational curriculum. We provide space, access to capital, mentoring, and then most importantly, access to the markets. And as we build these companies, we've essentially enriched the environment, the ecosystem in Chicago, to have more investable companies. The next step in helping these companies move downstream is getting access to growth capital. And growth capital is being defined as, those companies that have a product or a service, a set of customers that have validated their idea, and they're ready for Series A financing. And so the University of Chicago has made the strategic decision to use its endowment to carve out $25 million to co-invest alongside of other VCs in companies that are emerging from the University of Chicago that we think could really be game-changing technologies and products.
That's really excellent. And I love to see this happening right here in our own backyard, because so often we see companies kind of get going here and then run away to Silicon Valley or to New York or something. So it's wonderful to see all this investment here in Chicago business. Is there if you had to say, is there any kind of theme or through line with the type of companies? I know we've been doing a lot of kind of biotech and med tech here in Chicago, or is this really more open to a variety of entrepreneurs?
It's open to a variety of entrepreneurs. I think, you know, as we've seen, you know, come out of the university in the recent past, we've had great companies like Grubhub and Braintree that have gone on to become great successes, have created, you know, market valuations and exits in excess of $4 billion. So there's no question that when it comes to those types of products and companies, we have great interest. I do think that we are now seeing a lot of convergence of digital tech and connecting to other business verticals, especially in biomedical innovations, as well as renewable energy. And so I think we're likely going to see a lot more of those types of companies emerge. I mean, the things that are happening at the University of Chicago in cancer and immunology, for example, we announced a week or two ago, our partnership with AbbVie has led to four follow-on projects and investments into new breakthrough innovations in cancer, immuno-oncology products. You know, the things that are going on in big data applications and how we cure cancer from a precision medicine perspective. So you have all these assets and innovations happening and aggregating around cancer in particular. I think that's going to be, you know, likely a lot of companies coming out where the endowment may have opportunity to invest, as well as in things coming out of Argonne and Fermilab. Last week, we had Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz and Senator Durbin down to announce a new program at Argonne called Chain Reaction Innovations, where we're going to be supporting companies that are developing renewable energy coming out of the national labs.
That's really so excellent. And what I think is so interesting about this really is how this shift is happening within academia about how now suddenly there's sort of, I don't want to say a push, but certainly support and encouragement for faculty and researchers and students to kind of come together and really make kind of drive towards private companies that are coming out of this campus support system.
It's a very exciting time, and I think a lot of it's being driven by faculty and students. More and more of those individuals, especially top talent, are looking to go to a place where there's a fertile ecosystem where they have many options to make an impact on the world. Their primary motivation is to make a societal impact, and venture creation or partnerships with outside companies are becoming a more important, viable route to not only doing great science. For example, you know, a physician in the medical center may have a great idea, breakthrough discovery, but more of those scientists are not only interested in making the breakthrough discovery, but they want to see it in action. And they can do that through starting a company, bringing that product to patients by virtue of the commercialization process. A good example is a company called Explorer. It was started up by a surgeon in the medical center. They met a Booth student. They partnered with a University of Illinois Urbana engineer to get that company off the ground. And, you know, from idea through New Venture Challenge, we then invested innovation fund dollars in that company. They got their seed round from Pritzker Ventures. And, you know, these types of companies are beginning to emerge. That's a surgical workflow product that digitizes the operating room and could save, you know, millions of dollars for hospitals if successful. So I think you're just going to see a lot more of that convergence happening and a lot more interesting types of companies. And with this growth stage capital, that's to your point earlier, a lot of these entrepreneurs historically have left the region because growth capital isn't available. So they got a great idea, they validate it, they got momentum, but they can't get that growth stage capital. We need to catalyze more of that type of activity so that the stickiness of the talent stays in the region.
That's so fascinating, and I really love the convergence point that you're making, because I think that's so important. I think that's kind of been a contentious part of of academia for so long is kind of these silos that different, you know, vastly brilliant experts are working in. And for U of C to be, you know, to have this system and the support to put them together to accelerate these ideas, I think that's so fascinating and so wonderful. As you are going through this and working with these companies at these different stages, is there a type of support that you see the most, where you see, because I'm sure there's entrepreneurs listening and kind of taking note here, but, you know, is there a particular type of thing that is maybe often neglected, or maybe where you see the part you shouldn't try to do it yourself because it's the part where you need the support the most? What area would that be? Because I know you're looking at this from so many different, you know, areas as you're working with different companies, but where do you see that? Or is it very different based on different businesses?
Well, you know, we concentrate our program on the first year of life, where, you know, we say that we really can't guarantee success of any of these ideas. In fact, there will always be a high failure rate given the risky nature of these ideas and the deep complexity of the technologies and ideas being developed. But what we can do is shine a light on the pathway in that first year of life, you know, create, you know, an illuminated pathway so that the innovator has a good idea of options and connections to the market that they didn't otherwise have if they were working in isolation. And that's historically been the gap between academia and industry, is, you know, kind of this silo between industry and academia, where great discoveries are being made, but their application to the market may be just a little bit off. So opening up that portal where we see an increased number of larger companies that need to access more of these technologies, given their challenges. And at the same time, you have this trend for faculty that want to bring their idea to the world through this portal. Opening up that portal is the key goal, and transparency is key to the process. If I know what my options are, if I know what decisions I can make, I have a much clearer and better chance of being able to make the right decisions in that first year of life. So a lot of things can get screwed up: the wrong patent strategy, the wrong regulatory plan, hiring the wrong person. So we like to think about it as there's a number of things, you know, kind of vertical agnostic. It could be, you know, biomedical, mm-hmm. it could be energy, it could be computation. But these common principles of a full menu of decisions that need to be made, but making them transparent in that first year of life are the key to our program of hopefully increasing the throughput of more of these great ideas, you know, and onto the commercial pathway. Capital is just one piece of that mm-hmm. overall equation. I think people fixate on that first, but it's much more complicated.
Yeah, definitely. I think the phase of I don't know what I don't know, right? I think that can get a lot of entrepreneurs very sideways, and that's something we talk about a lot in this program. And it seems like you have, I love how you're saying this way of illuminating the path forward. I think that's a really wonderful thing that most entrepreneurs, when they tell their success story, their origin story much down the road, they usually point to something like that, where this suddenly they had fresh eyes on it, or they had more experienced eyes or mentors or something like that really showed them the options they had, that because they just, I think entrepreneurs just kind of put blinders on and just build and don't always look at the path ahead. Well, this is really, really fascinating. I hope you'll come back again and keep us updated on all the things happening there. John Flavin, Associate Vice President of the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Amy. Happy New Year.
Thanks. Take you care. Too. All right. We're going to take a little break and be back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Keep your radios on about 7 o'clock. I will be back. I'm going to take a little break, but I'm going to come right back and we'll start some New Year's Eve coverage, because there's already folks outside doing all kind of stuff. There is a protest going on, but there's also people that are festived up and wearing the New Year's stuff, and lots of people out on Michigan Avenue today. So starting at 7 o'clock, we're going to be watching the Chi-Town Rising Star doing its rising, and we'll be talking about some year-end review stuff. We will be looking at some of the movies and sports moments and tech moments and all of those things that made 2016 the year that it was, and we'll be looking ahead to 2017. And esteemed producer Griffin Filipich will be joining us a little bit by phone later this evening to share some of his knowledge and expertise in the film world, which I'm really super excited about.
Me too. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. I love that. Anytime you're on, I like it.
Thank you.
And so let us completely shift from that for a minute, because there's a story I'm dying to talk about before this year is out. And so the moments to do so are dwindling.
Yeah.
And this show is the one to do it. There is a story at Fast Company that made me laugh so much. It's really long, so you got to go through it on your own. But it is all about the 67 worst moments in tech in 2016.
Ooh.
And I try not to do too many of the worst kind of lists, but because, you know, it's an endless, right? You could come up with things like that all day.
Yeah.
But this is the worst moments in tech. And they're broadly defining tech. So there's all kind of things. But
yeah, because I feel like I had some of the worst moments in tech personally this year.
What did you do?
I don't know. Just
by not tweeting?
Not knowing how to work my computer or any of the technology in my life.
That time that I couldn't find that one printer cable and went nuts and screamed. Right.
That one time?
Right. Many times. Many times. There's some that I had forgotten all about. And you know, Griffin, you and I are looking at headlines so much. Especially tech headlines, but there was one, I forgot about this story, where Nikon camera company in Singapore, they awarded a prize to this very beautiful black and white photo. You're essentially like looking up some sort of industrial, I don't know, silo with a ladder sticking up, and then there's a plane perfectly centered at the top of it in the sky, and it's a very striking photo. And as soon as Nikon awards this, immediately the interwebs kind of go nuts, and they're like, that's Photoshop, and it's badly done Photoshop. And it turns out it was this really, really haphazardly done Photoshop job. And so Nikon had to apologize and take back this award, but it is a really beautiful photo. I mean, it's a beautiful composition either way, but if you look at it for more than a minute, not tiny on a screen, you will realize like, oh yeah, that's some.
That's not something somebody took with a camera, which is what Nikon should be most interested in or have the best eye for.
Right. That's the thing. You would think like a camera giant would be.
It's not a great look.
All up on that. Well, it was certainly, you know, peppered throughout this list is moments in politics. No matter how you voted, there were some really, strange moments on social media, certainly with candidates and then the president-elect, communicating with the people on social media. That was really, really unusual. You know, and I remember, when Obama won the first time, there was so much conversation about how he had used, data metrics and really took a look at that. And that really helped give him an edge. And I think after that, without really defining exactly all the things that he did, it seemed like a lot of candidates from presidential candidates all the way down ballot to, you know, right here in your neighborhood, you know, people really kind of felt the pressure, candidates anyway, of like, okay, we got to be doing this digital thing and with varying degrees of success. And, I feel like every time we looked up in the last probably 2 years, there was a local official of some kind of lawmaker, a politician running for office who would just tweet something that was like, what, why did you do that? What made you think that was a good idea? You know, there were so many that, I think we should do a search for lawmaker apologizes for tweet and just see where that gets us.
It'll get you far, I think, yeah. I like the ones where sometimes you'll get somebody retweets into my feed a tweet from like 5-6 years ago from somebody like a politician or business leader or somebody. And it's not anything scandalous or upsetting. It's just they clearly meant to text something. But it's also it's just like, oh, okay, that's the tweet, you know, where it's like, you don't know exactly what you're doing. Oh, I feel kind of bad.
Well, I
like stuff like that, though.
Sure.
It's a little look into their lives.
You like to make
and also,
feel
they
bad.
Haven't deleted it, is the funny thing. It's like, why didn't you just delete it?
Well, I think it's interesting, too, kind of the flip side of that is the way people use the search function in Twitter, right? If I'm searching for who all has tweeted about, I don't know, the Encyclopedia Britannica, that's just the first thing that came to my head. I'm going to do a search for Encyclopedia Britannica and see who's tweeted about that. And a lot of times I think people look for a keyword in that search and not necessarily look at the date on the tweet, and they'll just reshare something. And sometimes someone will retweet something of mine that's like 6 or 7 years old, and I'm like, but that's not even...
Yeah.
Well, or a headline I tweeted back then. Like I tweeted about, I can't remember who it was, but it was a celebrity death.
Yeah.
And then like I got retweeted just a couple of months ago and saying, oh no, this is tragic. And I was like, that was like,
it is tragic, but it was
2012.
Yeah, it was tragic. Yeah, it's a weird reminder that once you do that and then you forget about it, but it's still out there. You know, like everything's just floating around. You never know what's going to come to the surface. It's a weird place, that internet.
That interwebs. Yeah. I will say it seemed like kind of a little bit quieter year for brands making blunders, because it seemed like our politicians were doing such a good job of making blunders on social media that we didn't see as many from brands, or we just weren't noticing them as much. You know, I think in
everything
years past,
took a back seat.
Everything did, because it was such an unprecedented election. And there was KFC Australia that did an interesting, they had kind of this risque campaign going. And it was, they were promoting.
First of all, KFC running a risque campaign,
right,
is
let's
just.
Let's start there. They were promoting.
I love it. I love
they were promoting like this hot and spicy wing product, right?
Ah, okay.
And so they made these, like this, you know, sexy times happening in this area. But it got so much that people were, I mean, it had to use the NSFW, not suitable for work, hashtag, because it was, you know, it was a little gropey. This woman was like groping a guy.
Wow.
In the bathing suit area,
good,
you know.
So
they had to. They said we misstepped the mark, and they apologized and deleted the tweet. But I'm like, KFC, raunchy.
I mean, well, who hasn't, you know, had a hot date at KFC?
I have
no,
not.
No, really,
I have.
That's so 2017. Put it on the list. There you go.
That's the goal for me. Good times. Well, as we close up the final Wintrust Business Lunch of 2016 and look ahead to 2017, who knows this time next year what kind of headlines we will have talked about on this show and what things we will have seen develop in the technology world and in the business world. I hope that they are very positive, and I wish a lot of prosperity to Chicago entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs everywhere. And I wish sense and sensibility and sound judgment to the tech giants. We're counting on you to do the right thing. And I hope that we start having more positive discussions online. I know that's something that I talk about a lot, but I hope we start having a little more human-to-human discussions online with our social media, no matter what platform it is. And so with that, we are going to take a little break and then get you to news and check in with King John and all that, and then turn you over to him. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.